Are you working? What kind of work do you do? What is it you want to do when you grow up?
Hey, yo, I'm going to be a titter. That's all my eyes can see. Victory is mine. Yeah, surprisingly, I've been laying, waiting for your next mistake. I put in work and watch my status escalate. Now I'ma start collecting props, connecting plots, networking like a car.
Hello, comrades, and welcome to another episode of Sicko Mode. I'm Siang.
And I'm Joe.
Hello, what are we talking about today?
Well, we've got a excellent interview lined up for the sickos listening at home.
Yeah.
With Vic Cecchi-Ribeiro. All about his article called How Are Teachers Organized in a Pandemic? Mm-hmm. Some of you might have recently seen it in Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to put the link to the article in our episode description. But basically, it touches on workplace organizing, the new trade unionism, and how educators are finding ways to improve their situation during the pandemic. And it's a really great article. So we just wanted to get people kind of reading it, talking about it. And our episode will be like a supplementary guide to the article to get people maybe trying some of those organising tactics in their own workplaces.
So what is to be done for the NEU of 2020?
Exactly. The what is to be done for the millennial generation, for Generation Zoomer.
That's different from the millennial generation.
Well, we're in a coalition.
That is true. We are on the cusp. Well, I'm on the cusp.
Against Gen Z. I don't know. I'm a boomer.
You are.
It's funny, I just told everyone I'm 29, but this whole time I've been 48.
I could tell with your incessant rickrolling.
Hey, the kids love to rickroll.
That's true, actually. It's coming back around, it's the 20-year cycle. You're on the original swing.
So, listeners, for ages, Siang has made fun of me because I always do what's called rickrolling, which, if you're around in the early days of the internet, it's where you get rick... What's his face is... Never gonna let you go.
You can't even know the words.
I just like the air horn version without lyrics. But you get a link to that music video, then you disguise it, then you share it to people pretending it's something else, and you rick roll them. You trick them.
That really reminded me of when there was the original, like, when, like good, like, ITV News were reporting about the new trend of rick rolling. That was, like, the vibe that you were just giving me there.
Damn, yeah. I do have that kind of finger on the pulse of a kind of, boomer newsreader. But you told me recently the kids are still doing the rick rolling.
Yeah, actually, my friend, who is currently working at a high school, told me that some of the students had to go into self-isolation, so they were submitting their work online, and instead of... their homework or whatever it was, they just sent a YouTube link and it was a rickroll. And she was extremely shocked because this child is like 11.
See, I'm so in touch with the current moment.
Yeah.
I know that rickrolling is still good. I hope the end of that story is like, and that child is now the head teacher. Because he so thoroughly owned his teacher.
I hope not. I mean, if that were the case, you'd be like the Prime Minister of the UK, and that's not...
Exactly. And I should be.
I mean, okay.
I should be running the DfE, at least, the Department for Education. Yeah. I've said this multiple times. So we're meant to be doing a podcast on workplace organising, and we've just talked about the rickrolling renaissance.
Yeah.
That's not entirely relevant. But before we did get to our long-form interview with Vic Cecchi-Ribeiro, we did want to talk about the corona situation, right?
Yeah.
What is the current... What's the pandemic situation? Is there an equivalent of, like, the doomsday clock for, like, the pandemic clock that we
it's
can
bad.
Refer to?
It's like back to exponential graph.
Yeah, fellas, stages. It's bad. The line's going up.
The line's going up.
And yet people seem to care much less than they did before.
Yeah.
Is that accurate? Has the new hegemony successfully been built by the Tories for a kind of apathy and confusion?
You know, as you were saying... Back in the day of the original lockdown number one.
In the vintage lockdown.
While they were pretending that herd immunity was not their policy. Herd immunity has actually been their policy all along.
Yeah, we've always said
playing
it was.
The long game.
Yeah, herd immunity, i.e. let everyone die. Because herd immunity does not exist in the way that they pretend it exists, obviously. Mm-hmm. That would be like kind of like a mass inoculation. This instead is just letting it rip through the population. So that the line on the GDP graph goes up this quarter... the same rate as the line on the death graph goes up. But of course it won't actually go up. The economy will still stagnate.
It will still be tanking.
New Zealand, a comparative country, is going to be like, is going to be reeling it in.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't Jacinda Ardern just win like a 69% majority?
Wait.
Yeah, she's actually 20 points ahead. Like, she's just like completely owning all the centrists.
I just keep thinking about how in China, they're all just like having parties and like going to clubs.
Yeah.
Or, like,
if we lived in Vietnam, we'd be clubbing right now.
We'd be chilling.
Instead, we're literally, you know, going to go back into second lockdown. Yeah, some New Zealand politician was saying, like, in New Zealand, we currently have one case and we've had like one death this month.
Yeah.
Britain has had 15,000 cases in the last 24 hours.
Well, yeah, it's like yesterday, though. Day before yesterday, there was like 18,000 new cases.
Dear God, that's so many.
And
Homerton College here just locked, like, what, 200 students up together and they're all just getting it in this massive
in one room, in one building.
And only one comes out. Survival of the fittest.
Tiny rooms. There was actually an art lock. The way that lockdown is handled, I think is very reflective of the British spirit, which is everyone was emailed at 9:28 telling them that they would have to stay in their rooms from 9:30.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who doesn't love that high stakes? 2 minutes to get what you need.
Exactly.
Yeah. So more seriously, I mean, like, the Independent Sage has released a series of recommendations to get us through
circuit breaker.
Yeah, they're suggesting that after the circuit breaker ends, that there's going to be like real severe measures back in place as well. Not quite full lockdown, but certainly looking a lot more like full lockdown than what we have now. In order to get through. And people might want to look at those Independent Sage recommendations. And they might be forming the basis of things that trade union groups are demanding locally and nationally. Because obviously something really has to change.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, right now the government seems like it's going to do absolutely nothing and just kind of just keep on walking headlong into the abyss of keeping basically everything open. Like, they even seem to be intending to keep schools open in whatever version of a circuit breaker lockdown they may do, even though those have now been proven to be virus hotspots. So really just bizarre behaviour, just so corporate landlords and employers can keep getting people in just to try and, like, you know, they're cracking ribs in this corpse they're trying to resuscitate of the economy, and they're still just, like, pressing ahead, you know? Oh, Jesus. Anyway. And test and trace, right? I mean, that's the one thing. If you wanted to have everything completely open and no lockdown, you need a good test and trace, right? How is the British test and trace?
The mood is Microsoft 2003 paperclip, looking extremely distressed.
Yeah, it's that paperclip, but it's melting like the Terminator in Terminator 1, and it's all just turned into like this horrific thing underneath.
Yeah.
Basically, it's an absolute catastrophic failure. For instance, the island track and trace system costs like $773,000. The UK system costs like $12 billion. I can't even read it, it's such a big figure. And theirs works and ours doesn't.
Does not work.
And I've talked to a lot of people recently who are just like, there's no public trust whatsoever. Like, they don't want to share their data, they don't believe it works.
It's also just really weird, like, if you download it, it will just every so often just tell you that you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive, but that you shouldn't do anything and it's fine.
Yeah, right. It's already been completely, they've had to, in order to keep going with what they want to do, they've had to basically lie and forge, you know, different conclusions.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard of lots of teachers being told to turn off the app when they're in their workplace.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it will go off like crazy.
Yeah.
And shut the school down. So they've been told to turn it off. So
good,
it's like,
time.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant.
And like, I was listening to Radio 4 this morning. A bad idea, but you know.
Never do that.
It was getting me up, motivated with, you know, my blood was boiling.
Yeah.
So.
Angst and disgust. Okay.
And they're all like, you know, peddling the line of like, they got this person who does like disaster intervention or whatever, like this NGO business. And it's like, yeah, after it's generally after 6 months that people start being resentful of like restrictions or like new rules. And it's like, this actually does not have to be the case. Like, the reason why people are resentful is not just a natural human reaction to having to do anything. It's because of the way that the government has been doing it and the lack of trust, like the completely rightful lack of trust in the government and any of the measures that they tried to implement. That's the reason why people are annoyed and like can't be bothered with it. And it also means that when like trade unions and other groups try and ask for or like campaign for the restrictions that we actually do need in order for it to be safe in the long term, then people, like, then these groups kind of become like the new enemy who are trying to remove your freedoms.
Yeah, it's just desperate, isn't it? They just need to blame someone somehow. I mean, lockdown showed that actually people can be extremely malleable and accommodating if life necessitates it.
Yeah.
And it's not like, I try not to be like an actual like lockdown fetishist. Like, I know it would be much, much better if we had a really, really, really good test, track and trace and isolate system and people could actually go on with their lives and the people that were sick could get looked after and have accommodation to do that. But that is not the case.
Yeah.
So right now, if we want to like pull the emergency brake on the catastrophe express, that is going to require some scaling back of like everyone having hot tub parties in their favorite local restaurant and whatever they're currently being encouraged to do, and like coughing in offices and like the notoriously overcrowded and, you know, in state of disrepair British schools.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but that brings us really nicely to our interview, where we do talk about what some of the National Education Union demands have been recently and the kind of work that's been going on at the ground level and at national level. And I think it's a really great interview. So I would definitely recommend reading the article first that Vic did.
Yeah.
And then pour yourself a glass of wine or a glass of orange juice, get in the bathtub and then put the episode back on. Yeah.
Are you working?
I work here.
Boy, what is it you want to do when you grow up?
First, for those of us who are, you know, uninitiated, could you explain what the NEU is and also when and why you joined?
Yeah, so the NEU, the National Education Union, was formed as an amalgamation of two unions. So that's the National Union Teachers, the NUT, and the Association of Teachers and Lecturers, which is the ATL. So it's got a membership around 450,000 members, sort of contrary to recent trends in our movement. That saw an increase in 50,000 members, and I think more significantly, I think something like 3,000, I think something like 10,000 new reps. So a significant number of reps. So our rep density nationally actually increased from 28% to 40%, which is still far too low. But we can sort of talk about why that may have happened in a further question. So I joined when I first started teaching. Now, I've always been an active trade unionist and a Marxist as well. So for me, you know, I'm a teacher because I want to transform the education system, but I also want to transform society. You can't do that individually. You can only do that collectively. So it's really important that at a local level, in a school level, you're able to popularise and agitate for not only demands to do with pay and workload, but also linking to and connect the dots to the people that you work with, to what's happening politically and economically as well. Because, you know, then you can get some real sort of change. You can sort of increase the confidence of workers, you know, the idea that they are workers, not only in the work in school, but also think about what's happening in the community as well. So I've been teaching for 5 years. And I've been a workplace rep in my school for 3 or 4 years as well, not only for the school, but for the Multicami Trust as well.
So were you were in the National Union of Teachers and active just before the merger then, is that right, timescale?
Yeah, correct, yeah.
Right, and were you a Marxist this whole time? Did your Marxism precede your trade union activity, or is it the other way around?
Okay, so think back all the way back to 2010.
Oh, great times.
So Gordon Brown, wasn't it? Gordon Brown just lost the election. Mm-hmm. And back then I was a bit of a sort of soft left. soft left social democrat. Sort of my illusions in that were shattered, because I thought, oh, no, surely know, Labour's got to turn to left here. You know, you've had 13 years of New Labour. That's not worked. But, no, that didn't happen. So there was a protest in against the cuts in Tower Hamlets. Yeah. And I got into contact with the Socialist Party, which is used to be called Militant. And I was in the Socialist Party for about 2 years. And sort of organisation is sort of a lot of things wrong, not necessarily the best with it. But actually, that was my first in contact with people who are Marxists. It was the first time I ever read Marx, Lenin, Trotsky. I was sort of able to link what was going on in terms of the outside world to political theory. So in terms of sort of developing sort of a historical materialist analysis of what was going on at the time, also linking it to, you know, sort of, you know, the impact of neoliberalism and the austerity that was starting to come in terms of job cuts, swinging job cuts, you know, through that period. So I've been a Marxist since. So I was active in Unison at the time. So I was the branch secretary of Unison Queen Mary University of London, so the branch secretary of that, and I've been a sort of trade unionist and a Marxist since.
Yeah, well, it's not a dissimilar journey to my own. I think I moved to London in 2011, and I was attending the student protests then in that same moment, and then but I ended up becoming an anarchist, and it was many years before I got involved in the National Education Union. But by the time I did, I found it was kind of interesting how there were lots of people in it who were actually just, they had just kind of got involved in it because of workplace organising. And maybe they didn't consider themselves explicitly political beforehand. And then they start kind of getting involved in the NUT or ATL or eventually NEU when they merged a couple of years ago. And then they're kind of like, then you have all of these people who maybe are steeped in Marxism and that kind of tradition, but also people who are just kind of drawn from their actual workplace organising into that orbit.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's quite interesting, I think, now, is that within the NEU, you've got a layer of, you know, particularly younger workers who've been politicised over the last 3-4 years. And that politicisation, as well as being in the workplace, and that's from, you know, seeing firsthand children coming in hungry, seeing the increases in class sizes, you know, seeing increase in workload, you know, the impact of fragmentation of academisation, performance-related pay, sort of neoliberal reforms to do with Ofsted. So I think there's sort of a greater political consciousness at the moment within the teaching profession, particularly with younger workers. That what's particularly interesting as well is what's greater now is you've also got those same workers who've been active in the Labour Party since Jeremy Corbyn's election, in terms of connecting that into more sort of socialist thinking as well. I think our role as workplace organisers, as NEU members, is trying to really politicise NEU members into, you know, things around sort of housing and racism, as well as what's going on politically as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that how you describe that movement into the union currently, and I'm glad you brought up that big spike in membership we had, because obviously there was that article out not too long ago that talks about how all unions had a kind of spike in membership over the pandemic, but NEU was like the big winner, taking the W with that, like, 50,000 new members, but also, more importantly, that rep density. And it's quite interesting thinking of that proportion. Like, a lot of people would just think, oh, more members equals good. But I think there's always that kind of issue of scale. Like, if you think about someone like Unite or Unison, like they're just over 1 million members or whatever. But if it's not kind of cohered into a fighting entity, like if you don't have a rank and file movement, obviously you might not be getting that much done in terms of actual workplace victories or tangible benefits for your members. Whereas a quite small union like the CWU, the UCU, FBU, they all tend to be a little bit more left-leaning and in touch with their membership, often just because of terms of size. And so I'm glad that NEU, while it's scaling up, is like constantly seems to be also growing in its rep density, although of course this is like kind of a mixed picture, as you allude to.
Yeah, and I think this is the big question, something that in anyone who will listen to me in the union's leadership, with district secretaries, the people in campaigns and bargaining, if that membership increase has got to translate into a rank and file movement, what's going to be really important now is, what do we do with all those new members? What do we do with all those new reps? And for me, it's got to be about having workplace-focused organising around campaigns, so health and safety, for example, but also things on racism and housing, as also mentioned earlier, as well, because there's a big opportunity there, and a lot of those members and reps sort of got active engaged out of necessity, but the fear is that when the pandemic eases, that dissipates. So it's incredibly important that there's some real strategic thought about what we do about this, and credit due, the unions, the people I know who are involved in campaigns and bargaining, they're really pushing a rep focus. So there's a reps app that's coming out today. We've done a lot around.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, having
newsflash. There's a reps app coming out. Okay, what app?
Yeah,
it's dropping.
Yeah,
I didn't know this. I'm genuinely surprised. This is me. Yeah,
are you going to download the app?
I'll download the app immediately.
Yeah, so you've heard it here first. it's bit of a toolkit, to be honest. It contains because the website isn't the best traversed, to be honest. So it's to say the least. So it's just easy in terms of finding resources and things like that. But it's indicative of a greater focus on reps and workplace organising.
That's great. Well, in a second, let's talk about your recent fantastic Tribune article. It was literally like red meat for me. It was all of my favourite things in one place. But just before then, maybe you could could you explain why reps or representatives for the union in workplaces are so important, and why there's been such a big push to have a rep in every workplace as a kind of ideal that we should be fighting
for? Yeah, because ultimately, let's start with the bigger picture stuff. We want the transformation of the education system and society, and you can't do that without having workers organising and developing the power of workers in a workplace. And if those workers are not organised, then that's never going to happen. So what we would see is a workplace rep is someone is an organizer in that workplace, organizes the class, our class in that workplace as well, because in every workplace, it's about who has agency, who has control over how that workplace is run, and where does power and decision making lie. And having a rep is that first step to engaging, organizing and politicizing those workers in that workplace. And if we are to transform the education system and indeed society, you've got to have that in every single workplace in a local area, because there'll be certain things that are specific to a local area. But these things have to start from the bottom up. They have to be grassroots. And so it's got to start from that sort of base level. It can't come from the top. And we might talk about this later in terms of the limitations of the NEU's campaign in the summer around schools reopening and why that necessarily hasn't led to demands on distance learning around smaller class sizes, but it's got to start from that workplace rep, that organizer of workers in the workplace.
So as mentioned before, you have written recently an excellent article for the Tribune which examines the NEU's role in the pandemic, and specifically goes into analyzing organising on the ground, but also the direction for NEU in the future. Could you, take us through a little?
Yeah, so in terms of the NEU's role, so I'll sort of speak on what we did in my school, Montgomery Trust, and sort of map that out against what the NEU's national strategy was, sort of running parallel to that. So sort of before the pandemic, so our union nationally, so rep density was just under 30%. So you've got to consider that means most schools haven't got a workplace rep, and that's quite reflective of the wider labour movement in my multi-academy trust. So a multi-academy trust, so you've got academies, which are a bit like charter schools in the US. It's sort of semi-privatisation. So my sort of academy chain is about 25 schools in the north of England. So our rep density was around 50%, and that's through sort of doing organising work over the last 6 months to increase that. So even though it wasn't where we want it to be, it was still higher than our national average. Sort of when the pandemic hit, we were able to see what's happening in Scotland, in other countries in the UK, and also across Europe as well. So we in our sort of Model Academy trust, we sort of knew to sort of think around demands pretty quickly. And we sort of focused around clinically vulnerable workers be able to work from home, those who are extremely clinically vulnerable be able to do the same, around agency supply workers. We saw immediately that they're going to be absolutely hammered in terms of in the pandemic, and indeed they were. So we sort of focused on ensuring that there was no loss of pay for any of them. If they had contracts, they would be honoured throughout the pandemic. We also looked at start thinking around sort of if there were to be rotors, ensuring that they were sort of volunteer based and there'd be sort of no accountability or monitoring of those rotors at the same time as well. So we were sort of ahead of the union nationally in terms of coming up with specific demands. So what the union nationally was focused on is sort of ensuring that once schools had closed down, there was a big push around the union nationally to recruit health and safety reps. So that was sort of running alongside the work that we were doing. In terms of in our multi-academy trust, we sort of knew, particularly as those sort of first six weeks passed, so as we were entering through past Easter, there started to be talks around schools reopening, which would have been on June the 1st. So we knew immediately that that would be clearly unsafe. A lot of schools are in working class and communities that have high proportion of Black and Asian people in, so who were both groups disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. So we knew that no way could that happen. So I literally got up the membership lists of all the schools that didn't have a union rep in our multi-academy trust, and I just ran and spoke to as many members as I could, and had, we'll speak about this later, sort of around structured, organised conversation. So I just said to them, has your school got a union rep? Okay, are you prepared to go in school in 3 weeks? You're going to go back in school in 3 weeks, you haven't got a union rep. What are you going to do about it? And literally over 2 or 3 days, our rep density increased from 50 to 90%. And that's been the case since. So one of the sort of things that, one of my frustrations though, is like, why wasn't that happening sort of in other areas? But maybe it was to a limited extent, and maybe that's behind the increase in rep density. So once we got those new reps, it was a case of giving them, giving them experience organising their workplace. And in their first few days as reps, we put together a letter. And this letter was actually, it was done nationally, but we gave it sort of to them. So we had a reps meeting on Zoom, and it sort of emphasised the position of non-negotiation with our head teachers, saying that we refuse to negotiate with you on reopening, because regardless of having the safest risk assessment, having lots of sort of antibacterial wipes or whatever, or cleaning spray, it's just not safe. And we got over 150 signatures from schools across our Model Academy Trust, and lo and behold, none of our schools did open on June the 1st. And that's sort of compared to other chains like Oasis, United Learning, that did on June the 1st. So that was a real example of sort of grassroots organising done digitally as well. That worked and succeeded. In terms of nationally, the union strategy was very much focused on going into the community. So we had a petition that was based on, it's not safe to reopen, and that got over 400,000 signatures. And that was quite good at popularising what we called our five tests. I was focusing on testing, which we still haven't got, around, you know, those who are at risk be able to work from home, around, you know, class size and things like that. So there was also focus around councillors. So a lot of Labour councillors sort of were contacted, particularly Labour councillors were contacted. And as a result, I think something like two thirds of schools didn't reopen in the way the government had intended. But I think nationally, though, what was missing and sort of the big hole in that strategy, you know, it was a big, vibrant national campaign. It was oppositional from the leadership. You got absolute deluge of negative headlines from the sort of the capitalist press, the right wing press. However, once those weeks in June passed, that action wasn't grassroots enough. It wasn't embedded on sort of a rank and file demanding those things. And then what we then saw is that once school started going back, there wasn't really much we could do as rank and file members, lay members, to push the leadership to be bold and radical. I actually say to them, I know you're getting pelters from the press and the government, etc., but no, you have to say sort of strong in your demands. And as a result, and by not having that rank and file presence, our demands that we put nationally on September in terms of there needs to be a plan B for exams, around there needs to be smaller class sizes. So you could have seen buildings requisitioned, all of those things we were unable to secure, which has sort of led us to us having quite a chaotic half term. And let's be clear, quite an unsafe half term as well, because it's simply impossible at the moment to socially distance, let alone 1 meter at the moment. Some classrooms simply aren't big enough. If you're classroom with 30 people in them, there's no way you can track asymptomatic cases at the moment. So there's a lot of work to be done nationally, and us, and that's got to come from us. People are politicised. People are who understand organising. That's got to come from us at a grassroots level to build our own strength at a local level, rather than sort of waiting for our national leadership to say, okay, we're going to have a rank and file movement. It doesn't work like that. It's got to come from us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what your article elucidates so well, as a kind of almost like a case study or workers' inquiry, laying out how you kind of used rank and file organising to win those victories. Before we talk about kind of where NEU is at right now, just to take a kind of step back and focus on a few of those things that came out of your description of your article. I mean, firstly, That comparison between academies in the UK and charter schools in the US is a really interesting one. Because obviously charter schools in the US were like this kind of massive movement. I mean, like Obama said, his favourite film one year was Searching for Superman, a film celebrating charter schools.
Yeah.
And then listeners might, if you're not an education nerd like we are, listeners might not know just how kind of completely nefarious charter schools actually are. And pretty much all of the very worst billionaires in the world have their very own charter school. Even Jeffrey Epstein was involved in charter schools.
Of course.
All of the worst right-wing billionaires in the US as well. Yeah. All of the Illuminati, basically. they've been this kind of, they've used this language of like, oh, we're having a revolution in education. We're really changing things. We're going to get the best results, and it's like all of this kind of like, oh, we're helping people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and all of this language of liberation, at the same time as it's basically just a wholesale privatization of education. And going back to kind of schools, just as a kind of supposedly philanthropic endeavor, but really they're just kind of inculcating a class with a kind of neoliberal attitude, telling them that, if you don't strive, you die. You have to work twice as hard, every day, just to get by.
Aspiration.
Yeah, aspiration. And And so, like, and I think it was Blair that brought in academies here to be the UK's answer to charter schools. And also, specifically, he wanted them to be union-busting institutions, just like charter schools were, you know, to be schools which are more efficient, right? Because they don't have the same kind of meddling that, you know, the old schools with their union recognition agreements did. And so the idea was that academies would kill trade unionism off, finally, in the education sector. And yet what we've seen with what you're doing is that it sounds almost as if you'd organizing in an academy chain where they're all linked together has actually kind of enabled you to reach out to a lot of people who are all united by having the same kind of a big mat employer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So traditionally, and is the case in most places, unions are based on geography. So we call them districts. So there's a district secretary, a district and branch secretary, quite often does the two roles. And because of the fragmentation in the education system, so previously, though, that district branch secretary would negotiate with a single employer, which would normally be the local authority. But because of, as you described, what Blair and the academisation, and Lord Adonis, of course, in terms of what they brought through, is that became incredibly difficult, that model, because rather than negotiate with one person, in say, for example, Manchester, there's 30, 40 different mould academy chains and employers. So what we've been able to do in ours, though, is to organise the reps and members that have a single employer, which is a bit smaller, which is a lot smaller actually than a local authority. So you can use that to place more pressure. So my multi-academy chain is the co-op. So the co-op who run banks and shops. They
run... My bank accounts with co-op is a disaster.
Yeah.
Constantly freezing my card. Yeah, sorry. Irrelevant.
So they run schools as well. So we quite often lean into the co-op's shared history of the trade union labour movement. So in terms of what the union strategy is nationally, is we're trying to build a sort of a lead, having a lead rep in every multi-academy chain, using that as a bit of a network, and that naturally lends itself towards more of a focus on the employer. So actually, rather than union members thinking that their negotiation is done by someone from the outside and it's done sort of in the halls of the council, actually they start thinking about actually all the schools that we're in, we have the same employer, and it's this multi-academy chain. So it's sort of an interesting way, because obviously the fragmentation, semi-privatization, is bad, but at the same time there's an opportunity there to use it to reinvigorate elements of rank and file organising.
Yeah, it's interesting, those contradictions, isn't it? The very things that were kind of meant to fragment us, you then see kind of new coalitions emerging out of that in new ways. And I guess that relates to the other thing I was wondering about. You mentioned how a lot of your organising during the pandemic was, obviously necessarily digital. And so I've done a lot of stuff with NEU, and I often find there's been an over-reliance on digital, we are organizing with members, we send them an email every month, and often that face-to-face organizing is missing. But then I've also done organizing with Acorn, where there's an absolute emphasis on face-to-face and avoiding digital at all costs, apart from kind of communications, because you want to get talking to people on the door, maybe even in their houses, and certainly at least over the phone. And so I find it interesting now how, everyone's kind of having to adapt, and people are now using digital tools in a way which is more kind of focused on that kind of persuasive conversations or kind of structured conversations, and actually trying to access people and build trust and build confidence in kind of new reps, even when you might not technically be allowed to share the same space and you kind of have to do it at a distance. I mean, how have you utilised kind of digital tools during your organising research?
Yeah, so what we've done is we have regular reps calls, and I think it's what the relationship and the nature of those calls are, because what it could be is just me just reading off what I've done in terms of negotiation, it being quite operational, and the reps there are there to listen. However, the way that we structure it is before our sort of video reps call, we say to the reps, now you've got to hold a members meeting before it, and you've got to find out what are the issues that are that your members are really widely and deeply felt, and come and share with us what's working in your school in terms of your organising, what your success is, what you find difficult. So actually, when we have that digital meeting, it's led by the reps. The reps are saying, okay, the members in my school have said this. Okay, the members in this school have said this. This is what my members meeting was like. This is what my head teacher said. And actually, my role in that meeting is to unite and collectivise all those issues, as well as formulating some demands that we then take to the employer. So what's important is the person chairing that meeting, the person who set up the meeting, it really clearly knows what to get out of it. Other than that, digitally, we've done things like reps letters, members letters as well. What that's involved is, so for example, around school reopening, is members putting their names down. And what we did was, when we got 50% of the signatures, we posted it to all the members so they could sort of see, okay, actually loads of people have done this, I'm going to do it as well. We also did it to sort of shame a few members as well, maybe some who were middle senior leadership. So, well, actually, no. And actually people say, my manager hasn't signed the letter on us having a safe workplace. We sort of use that sort of increased turnout as well. But yeah, the main sort of digital tool we've used is, because at the moment, our Multicademy Trust is based across Yorkshire, Manchester, Wirral, Merseyside, is a means of getting people together so they feel part of a wider collective, and using it to sort of develop their own confidence. Okay, well, this is all the stuff. Oh, this is what they've done in their school, and they're a new rep as well. And sort of using it as well. So in the meetings of we do forms of political education. So I did a talk in a reps call around because at the time we were running an anti-racist campaign in our trust. So we wanted demands on decolonising the curriculum, wanted demands on PSHE to cover explicitly Black Lives Matter, to look at specific pastoral support for Black students, to have a no police in schools policy. So for us to do that, our reps needed to understand, and the training covered around the the roots of racism that's in capitalism and imperialism, from the past, but also how those inequalities, racial and class inequalities, reproduce themselves in the education system as well through exclusions, uniform behaviour policies, zero tolerance behaviour policies, and things like that. So in terms of there's loads you can do with it, but the person doing it needs to understand, actually, it's about the reps. It's about the reps being politicised, being developed, rather than you it being quite transactional and service orientated. You're they're there to listen to you.
So in your article, you talk specifically about structured conversations as a kind of tactic used, or a way to approach members and reps. Could you go into a bit more detail about what structured conversations are, how they work in your experience, and why they're effective?
Yeah, it's incredibly important, because it's the conversations that we have as workers. So back in April, May, our union nationally pushed, and it's not done it since, it was a bit surprising, Jane McAlevey strike school. So it went out in the communication to all reps back in April, May. So myself and a few other reps in Manchester went along to it, and sort of the training I got from it, I was then able to then use in terms of increasing our representativity in the mat. So a structured, organised conversation is, if you imagine you've only got 3-4 minutes with a member in your workplace, so it's about framing issues, because every member has issues in the workplace that are concerned often. And in the past, it's been too easy, and even now it's too easy for district secretaries or workplace reps to say, okay, my members are apathetic, they don't care, they're not interested, they never come along to meetings, they never reply to my petitions or my surveys. But actually, there's a reason that is, and that's because of the economic system. The economic system, no, it naturally makes them feel that they're not part of something, they've got no agency. What structured organised conversation is, takes people's existing issues and pivots it towards something that has to be dealt with collectively and specifically through a trade union group in the workplace, as well as, you know, that conversation runs alongside an action or a campaign you have in the workplace. That might be around a members' meeting, it might be about a petition that you have. So that conversation you have, and it's something along the lines of, okay, now you've got an issue with workloads, now you're saying that you've never got time for anything, you're marking too many books. The only way you can do that and deal with that is if you come to our members' meeting on workload and we bring this all together. And also with that conversation, it sort of inoculates, it prepares that worker for the boss's response. So, okay, so what do you think the head teacher is going to say if they see you at a union meeting? So you're actually sort of trying to all the time develop that individual's consciousness into a worker who's part of a workplace, who actually should have power, should have the decision-making capability in that workplace, because they're the one at the front, they're the one working, teaching for 20, 25 hours a week, rather than, you know, the boss who isn't. So it's a really effective tool, and we're really keen, I'm really keen as an organiser for every single rep to be able to do that, because that's the only way that we're going to build active, political, radical workplaces. And I think the last three industrial ballots that our unions had haven't crossed the threshold, and the only way that's going to change is by us, upskilling our reps, upskilling our members, as well as having bold demands nationally. It's not good enough that we could always say we're never going to win a ballot. And even sort of recently around health and safety, that's sort of some of the voices at the moment nationally is, we could ballot for strike action over the fact we're sort of in places that are clearly unsafe, because we will never win it. But how do we win it? It's things like structural organising conversations that's got to come from the grassroots that's going to do that.
Absolutely. And it's fantastic that systematic structured organising conversations have been shown to work, particularly the constraints you allude to, like the anti-trade union laws. We can't actually mess around. We do actually need to use them, because obviously we're never going to meet a ballot threshold. What is it? 50% members need to participate. With a gigantic union like ours, like fourth biggest in the UK, like one of the biggest education unions in the OECD countries, we're never going to meet anti-trade union Tory ballot thresholds if we don't systematically do these kinds of conversations. And, I hope this year is going to see a lot more kind of versions of the strike school and versions of that kind of training. I mean, I have actually been using structured conversations myself with trying to build the New Professionals Young Workers Network here. But I always allot about 20 minutes. And you say you're doing it in 3 to 4 minutes. I'm going to have to crunch my time, because that is obviously inefficient. I'm asking them about their lives. I'm building rapport and all of this. I should just be, what's your issue? Like, is that going to change if you do this or do that? Like, bring it to the workplace and kind of institute trade union consciousness. I'm just going to have to try and speed up that time, or it's going to take me years to
cut out the small talk.
Build power in Cambridgeshire. Yeah, I'm going to have to cut out the small talk. I've never been able to do that.
Yeah, no chatting, just...
I'm going to have to try. I mean, I think we're going to put on our own version of Strike School here soon if we can. Oh. So maybe I'll learn from doing that. Yeah, I mean, it's another reason that these conversations are so important is that, as you also allude to in your article, like the press, when NEU is campaigning to kind of not have an unsafe return on the 1st of June, the press was really gunning for us. Kind of, you could tell that the Daily Mail and whatever were really relishing having a kind of trade union bête noire again, because they'd obviously been missing one pretty much since the 80s. And they were so happy. They printed what several people from our executive and our general secretaries. They put their pictures in a big splash and they were like, you know, it used to secretly be a Marxist and all of these accusations, and tried to smear them. And it was really quite horrifying. All these people I'd seen around from conference, or I know from this meeting or that committee, suddenly they're just like having their private lives made, you know, that the papers are saying pretty much these people are good targets, like everyone have a laugh, like, you know, and underneath that was a kind of sense that they should be attacked or like held in you know, complete antipathy. And so it was quite a scary time. And so it's nice to think that the NEU at that same time was drawing on kind of like the new trade unionism and doing the same kinds of things that we've seen in lots of like kind of big education kind of union movements in the US and other places, of like trying to actually like turn to the community and build like a big kind of consensus around our demands and kind of, you know, put the collective back in collective bargaining. So you think that was effective then? What's kind of changed? Why do you think that kind of shift has happened and now we're a little bit more fragmented again?
Yeah. In terms of where we are now compared to the summer, or do you mean sort of after being hollowed out by neoliberalism for the last 40 years?
That would be a big question. Yeah, I meant more like, you know, in June we saw us really kind of, things were really starting to get going and tackling that kind of negative press image. And then kind of, as you've described, now things are a lot more mixed and yeah, there isn't that rank and file pressure so much as there was around the 1st of June. Like, why do you think that change happened over the summer?
Yeah, I think over the summer, I think our members were glad to have a break, and it's been difficult to kickstart that momentum since. You know, people over the summer were, you know, for the first time in months, were going out, were eating out to help out, in fact, and sort of amongst members going into September, in the absence of bold demands around sort of school reopening and that pressure nationally. I think nationally, there's a real fear of having those negative headlines from the press again, when actually I think we shouldn't be bothered about them.
Fuck them.
No, absolutely.
It's going to hate. Like, what are you going
to do?
What are you
going to do? Absolutely. So it's been difficult to kick that momentum again in September as well, and now. A lot of our members who would have been active online are now back in schools working 40, 50 hours a week. And without having that local rank and file presence in a school, it's, you know, it can be more challenging to kickstart that once more. So it needs to happen, because at the moment it isn't sustainable at the moment. No, they talk about a circuit breaker for 2 weeks. No, how significantly is that going to reduce cases over 2 weeks? And then, you know, we're going to be in the middle of winter. So I'm not sure it's sustainable to have the case that we crawl along in schools having lots of positive cases, then we wait for half term or Christmas, and that's going to be the case until there's a vaccine. You know, clearly there needs to be something a lot broader than that. But I think quite interesting, you spoke about a new trade unionism, and, you know, I'm really interested in what's happening in places like Chicago and LA with the teachers and education workers there. And, you know, this runs alongside in terms of building a rank and file presence. So in Manchester, we're doing a lot of work around housing and around anti-racism, because those are things that impact members. So our members will live in poor rented accommodation. No, they will pay increasing amounts off rent to a landlord, they will live further away from their school because they can't afford to live near it, particularly in cities like Cambridge, London, Manchester, across the country. So it makes sense, and this is what we've been doing in Manchester, building demands around housing, building links with groups like Acorn, Greater Manchester Tenants Union as well. So we had a district meeting 3 weeks ago, and we organised really hard around it. Now district meeting, we put forward a motion adopting to support tenants unions in Manchester, to support political demands for rent cancellation and an end to no-fault evictions, as well as supporting our trades council and start thinking about coordinating a coalition grassroots housing campaign. And for me, that's got to be the future of our union in terms of all the stuff we've spoken about today around health and safety, around academisation. We've got to do all that stuff as well, because that district meeting, half the people there were under 35, and I've been to quite a few district meetings. That's not normally the case, because we're talking about issues that really really engage people are really passionate about as well. So following that, what we're going to do with that is we're running Strike School for not only our members, but also people who are in Acorn, people who are in Greater Manchester Tenants Union, because actually developing their organising capacity benefits us as well. And we need to start thinking about, as trade unionists, not only within our own individual union, but start thinking about, our movement, the movement in our cities, in our regions. This isn't reinventing the wheel. These are sort of things that we used to do, used to do really well. We used to have sort of communist parties locally that would coordinate different struggles. But even though that there isn't a party, why shouldn't it be a trade union branch? Why shouldn't it be a group like Acorn that are starting to think about, how do we sort of unite different parts of our movement through commonality of struggle? Because what I do think now over the last 4 years is that not only in teaching, but also in other areas, in groups like Momentum, and I've spoke about Acorn, is that we've got people now who understand organising, we've got people who understand the need for political education, we've got people who understand these things, so why not bring them all together? And it makes sense for me is that we do look at housing, because it's an issue that unites so many different groups, and also in terms of an immediacy of an issue with the eviction crisis, impending eviction crisis coming up, it makes sense for people in our union to start thinking about, really entering that struggle.
In this business of rap. Are you working? I work here.
Boy, what is it you want to do when you grow up?
So that was our interview with Vic. Good times.
Yeah, vibing. One of our most vibing interviews ever. great guy.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting stuff was talked about. And so listeners, if you're at all interested, please do get in touch with us. If you want to ask more about workplace organising, mm-hmm. or the kinds of organising we were talking about with Vic, please do get in touch.
Yeah.
Particularly if you have a local Acorn group or branch, or if you have a local trade union branch, be it National Education Union or other, that you're getting involved mm-hmm. in, we're always happy to help with that. To build up that network and expand our coalition.
Yeah.
And look out soon. We'll have more stuff, I think, on this topic area of the new trade unionism and organising in NEU.
Building Acorn. Power.
Yeah,
in building power. In workplaces and the community.
Is there anything more delicious?
No.
It's good.
It was delicious.
Does Dust Vow want to live deliciously?
Yes.
Build power in your workplace.
Yeah.
All right, cool. All right. See you soon, listeners. All the best.